Hello there. Today is Wednesday, November 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump warns the leader of North Korea not to interpret past inaction as weakness.
This would be a fatal miscalculation.
New details reveal the gunman who killed 26 people in Texas had a dark past. A new climate summit is underway in Germany. Also ahead, a photo captured of a woman's hand gesture to President Trump as her seeking new employment. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is continuing his trip to Asia and on his way to China before leaving South Korea. He addressed the South Korean National Assembly, where he reassured U.S. support.
The weapons you are acquiring are not making you safer. They are putting your regime in grave danger. Every step you take down this dark path increases the peril you face.
And he sent a stern warning to North Korea's leader.
Today, I hope I speak not only for our countries, but for all civilized nations. When I say to the North, do not underestimate us and do not try us. We will defend our common security, our shared prosperity, and our sacred liberty.
President Moon Jae-in said after his meeting earlier with Trump that the two leaders agreed to cooperate on strengthening South Korea's defense capabilities through the acquisition of development of advanced weapons systems. South Korean government officials had been endorsing the nation getting nuclear-powered submarines amid calls for more military strength. There is a growing concern among the South Korean public that North Korea's expanding nuclear weapons arsenal, which may soon include an intercontinental ballistic missile that could target the U.S. mainland, would undermine Seoul's decades-long alliance with Washington. Meanwhile, there was some breaking news earlier coming out of South Korea. Joining us now for that part of the story, VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman, traveling with the president, who spoke with me from the National Assembly where President Trump addressed the South Korean lawmakers.
Before the president came to the National Assembly, he attempted to go to the demilitarized zone, that border separating North and South Korea, probably the tensest border in the world these days. Now, this is something that the White House had said was definitely not going to occur, although the president, earlier in remarks here in Seoul and back at the White House, had hinted that there would be some sort of surprise on his trip. So this is apparently what it was, and he got very, very close. What happened is they secretly took Marine One, accompanied by some Chinook helicopters from the Yongsan garrison in Seoul, and flew up towards the border, but there was fog, bad weather, and they waited around for a bit, hoping for a second chance to land. But according to White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the weather got worse, and they had to abort the attempt to land at the DMZ.
What it would be the significance if he had made it there and made an appearance?
Well, it would have been highly symbolic, for one, because you would have had this scene of the president of the United States with the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, at his side, staring across into North Korea and having North Korean guards staring back at them, sort of symbolizing at a very high level the tension on the Korean Peninsula. Now, this is something that Vice President Pence in a bomber jacket did earlier this year, and other members of the president's cabinet have done the same this year, and it's a trip that some previous U.S. presidents have also made. Now, Press Secretary Sanders says this is something that they had planned for before the president left on his Asia trip. It's something, quote, the president wanted to do, and, quote, he's actually pretty frustrated.
Do you think they may make another attempt to actually have him go there?
it doesn't really seem practical without throwing the president's schedule later in the day in China out of whack. It seems logistically almost impossible to try it again unless there's some major revision of the schedule, which would have to be done at the very last minute in coordination and with the consent of officials in China, ironically.
Right.
But who knows? This is a president who has a flair for drama, likes to surprise, and he certainly attempted to surprise.
The president's tone has been noticeably different since he's been there.
Yes.
Regarding
North Korea.
Of course,
the president in Washington has spoken of fire and fury and derided Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, as little rocket man. We have not heard that sort of rhetoric here. In fact, in appearances at the headquarters of 8th Army at Camp Humphreys, Pyeongtaek in South Korea, and at a joint news conference with President Moon Jae-in and in bilateral meetings, as well as at a banquet last night, a state dinner in his honor, his words have been quite reassuring. While speaking of resolve, saying worldwide action is needed to confront Pyongyang, he's also spoken of being there for South Korea, really giving a lot of reassurance and saying things such as that he, quote, wants to make things beautiful for South Koreans and help President Moon achieve his dreams. So, yes, a much more subdued and somewhat optimistic tone being expressed by the president so far.
All right. That's VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman. Thanks so much. He's reporting from the National Assembly in Seoul, South Korea. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Officials say Puerto Rico needs unprecedented federal help still. Immigration status is unsure for Nicaraguans and Hondurans in the U.S. Osama bin Laden's son is calling on followers to rise in rebellion. And Twitter doubles its character limit to 280 for nearly everyone. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, the gunman who killed 26 people at a Texas church Sunday appeared to have been motivated by a domestic dispute with his in-laws and, according to authorities, had sent threatening texts to his mother-in-law before launching the attack. Kelly's in-laws attended the First Baptist Church from time to time, although investigators said they weren't at the church at the time. However, one of the shooting victims was the grandmother of his ex-wife. Joining us now is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, it would appear that this was related to some sort of domestic dispute, but we've already learned that he's also had a pretty shaky past, including some alarming violence and mental health issues. It's, of course, bringing up the questions of mental health issues and how was this man able to get this type of gun?
The real problem that we have here is this was a failure of the system and maybe an approach to a system to make sure that certain people should not have guns. It is that simple.
The president said if it hadn't been for a bystander that had a gun and stopped him, a lot more lives would have been lost. Again, saying this isn't a good time to be talking about the gun issue. It doesn't sound like there really is any political will to take on gun violence in the United States. But if you look at the statistics, and you're a criminal defense attorney, I'm sure you see it, we are a significantly higher rate of gun violence in this country than mostly anywhere in the world.
Well, if you take a look at the numbers, and the numbers simply don't lie. The estimate is that the United States has about 4% of the world's population and about 46% of the world's guns. We love guns. And what makes it worse is that we have no political will to address the issue of what to do with all of these guns. We simply don't. We've seen this in the past. No matter how many people die, no matter how many children die, no matter how many innocents die, there still is no real viable desire to actually address this issue. How long is the outrage going to last on the Texas case? It will be gone by the end of the week.
How big of a problem do you think it is regarding these types of murderous assaults related to domestic violence? And why, if it had to do with domestic issue with his own personal issues, would he go and just kill a bunch of innocent people, including many children?
It's a really tough question because it's hard to dip a toe into that intellectual pool. We don't know why people jump to the conclusions that they do, but here's what we do know. We do know that domestic violence breeds true violence, including assaults with weapons. There's a reason that people who are convicted of domestic assault and domestic-related crimes are and should be denied weapons. Frequently, the oversight that we see right now is both federal and within the states. So individual states can deny people weapons to some degree. And then there's also a federal question on exactly who should and who should not be able to own weapons. In this particular case, that was the major failure. In this particular case, this man should not have been allowed to own or get access to weapons. And yet, he did.
How, though? I mean, even Texas Governor Greg Abbott said that this guy was a powder keg waiting to go off. I mean, it's clear, according to the governor, that he had violent tendencies. He apparently had escaped from a military mental health facility. He had been charged with animal abuse, domestic abuse, hurting his own stepson, literally, I believe, even fracturing his jaw or skull or some sort of violence to his wife and stepson. And yet this happened. So even if we had stricter gun laws and background checks, would they work? Where did we go wrong here?
They only work if there's sufficient funding to make sure that they're enforced. That is one of our fundamental problems, which comes down to will, in my opinion, again. If we really don't have the will to stop this, simply what we can do is we can pass any law we want. And by the way, we haven't frankly passed that many, but even the laws that we do have, if we really don't want to stand up and stop them, we simply don't fund them. And if we don't fund them, that means that people can do just about anything that they want. Sadly, that's what we're seeing here again.
All right. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thanks as always. We appreciate your perspective. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, French authorities say President Donald Trump is not among more than 100 world leaders invited to Paris for a climate summit next month. French President Emmanuel Macron plans a summit to push his Make Our Planet Great Again agenda on December 12th, the anniversary of the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. A French diplomatic official said the countries invited are those who are, quote, especially committed to applying the Paris Accord. Trump has said that the U.S. will pull out of the accord unless he can secure a better deal. Meanwhile, a two-week-long U.N. climate conference in Bonn, Germany is now underway. And while diplomats and activists gather, the U.N. Weather Agency says the 2017 is set to become the hottest year on record. Joining us now to discuss is Luke Kemp, climate and environmental policy expert at Australia National University. So first of all, what is the purpose of this current summit in Bonn?
So the latest climate talks are about trying to clarify what's called the Paris rulebook. So the Paris Agreement really is the skeleton, and a lot of the details that make it operational still need to be fleshed out. And those need to be confirmed and agreed to and adopted by 2018, next year. So the point and purpose of this conference is to really try to clarify those rules and make sure that Paris can be implemented in the strongest way possible. Apart from that, I feel like these conferences now just have a more of a political purpose. It's about creating a sense of momentum and a sense of urgency about how drastic the problem is, which can hopefully then be taken back to countries and help to ramp up action.
Right.
Whether that actually occurs is questionable.
Well, of course, it's certainly raising questions about the role of the United States and whether other countries will have to step up with their absence since President Trump decided to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. How much of an impact could that have?
I personally don't think it'll have that large of an impact, at least in terms of emissions or anything that's worthwhile. When you look at the legal impact of withdrawal, it means very, very little. All it really means is that the U.S. doesn't need to put forward a new pledge every 5 years. That's it. There was no legal obligation to meet their pledge. So what this means is it doesn't actually change the emissions of the U.S. It doesn't change how much climate finance the U.S. is providing. The only potential large impact it could have is creating a domino effect, inspiring other countries to withdraw. In the short term, what we've seen is exactly the opposite. It's actually galvanized countries like China and Europe to kind of re-engage with the Paris Agreement and take on stronger action domestically. Ultimately, I feel this could actually backfire on President Trump to some extent. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the longer term.
Well, it's interesting that you said it could backfire. I mean, you know, he talked a lot about bringing back coal, and it would seem that seemed like the train has already left the station when it comes to renewable energy, and coal is sort of, it would be hard to bring back something that isn't as economical or clean. Do you agree?
Yeah, so President Trump cannot beat market forces. Coal is in structural decline and was already dead before he was elected. He can't resurrect coal like some kind of Black Lazarus. Ultimately, already as it stands, renewable energy employs more people than the U.S., and perhaps more importantly, it's already becoming cheaper when it comes to new generation. So it's just a no-brainer to go with renewable energy over something like coal. And when you factor in the health costs, of course, environmental costs, et cetera, it becomes just an impossible case to try to install new coal-fired generators in the U.S. Regardless of Trump's intentions, this is one battle he can't win.
It would seem that we're already sort of getting a taste of what is ahead, given here in the United States and in the Caribbean, you know, some of these storms that have just been not necessarily caused by global warming or climate change, but certainly seem to have been strengthened by the warm waters. You know, you're in Australia. What are people around the world, as far as you can tell, and the people that you've talked to, thinking regarding the United States' current stance with this administration regarding climate change?
I think there's widespread condemnation. No one is viewing the United States' position on climate change very favorably at this moment. Granted, most of the people I know and associate with are usually not skeptics, but in general, I think even the skeptics now are accepting that renewable energy is a better choice and that there's a lot of co-benefits to taking on and decarbonizing rather than trying to go ahead with coal. But right now, I really do believe this has made the U.S. into somewhat of a pariah on the international stage. Under President Barack Obama, even though the U.S. really wasn't taking a leadership role, it needed to do far more in terms of reducing its emissions and in terms of supporting other countries. At the very least, there was some kind of symbolic leadership about what needed to be done. And unfortunately, it has just gone utterly and totally backwards with the U.S. now.
This latest U.S. climate report really had a pretty daunting assessment of just how much the climate is warming and that humans are, in fact, again, causing, I mean, just reinforcing what scientists had already been saying, but it seemed in even stronger language, which seems to contradict what the administration is saying. Ultimately, what is your view on that? What is your view on this latest report and where we are as a planet, as a global community?
The conclusions of the latest report were totally and utterly expected. Every time we have a new IPCC assessment report, for example, it just ends up happening that it becomes clearer and clearer how strong a role humans are having in changing the climate. And it also becomes clearer that the impacts have been understated in the past, that we're actually facing more quick, more drastic, and more damaging impacts when it comes to increased hurricane frequency as well as strength, droughts all around the world, et cetera, extreme weather events. All of these have appeared to be, to some extent, understated and underappreciated in previous reports. And unfortunately, I feel like the news is not going to get any better. The world has agreed to try to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is widely accepted as being a safe limit of warming. And unfortunately, we're already approaching 1.1. So 1.5, unless very, very quick and drastic action beyond the realm of what is politically feasible at the moment is taken, then it appears that we're on on the wrong track towards 3 degrees or more, which would be catastrophic for all humankind.
All right, Luke Kemp, we appreciate it. He's the climate and environmental policy expert from Australia National University.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists in Chile have found a new heart failure treatment that uses umbilical cord-derived stem cells may lead to remarkable improvements in heart muscle function and quality of life for those suffering from this condition. The American Heart Association says heart failure means that your heart isn't pumping blood as it should and is unable to keep up with the body's need for blood and oxygen. Heart failure is usually treated with medication and changes in lifestyle. The researchers found that a year after heart failure patients were given this new treatment, they showed a significant and continued improvement in their heart's ability to pump blood and had an improved quality of life. They also found the treatment was safe with no adverse effects. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, turning now to what's been trending on social media, we are joined by VOA's Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, let me tell you a story, Lori.
Okay.
Back on October 28th, a woman named Julie Briskman was out riding her bike in Virginia when who should come up alongside her but President Donald Trump's motorcade. Now, Trump had been out golfing at the Trump Golf Course in Sterling, Virginia, which is just outside of Washington, D.C. Now, it's safe to say that Julie Briskman is no fan of the president because as the motorcade went by, she raised her hand in a one-finger gesture that expressed exactly how she felt about President Donald Trump.
Was it a middle finger?
It was.
Okay.
And as she did that, a photographer who was traveling in the presidential motorcade captured the moment.
Okay.
Now, within days, this photo had gone viral across the internet. It went on all the late night talk shows, making Briskman a hero for some and earning her scorn from others.
Okay.
And you can imagine where the scorn and the heroics fall as far as party lines. Well, also within days of that photo going viral, Briskman was fired from her job as a government contractor because of the photo. Now, it seems that she put up the photo as her profile picture on social media, which, according to the company that she worked for, was a violation of their policy governing employees' social media use and lewd or obscene things put out on social media. Now, Briskman's case is sparking outrage from the left, from free speech advocates. They're saying that she's being unfairly fired for expressing her views, considering this was not on work time. She did not make any expression of where she worked. This was her own free speech, is what they argue.
She'll probably end up being a celebrity and making money off of that.
Well, she already is a little bit on social media. She's been interviewed by a bunch of people. She's become this kind of hero on the left for progressive political people. Briskman says she doesn't regret doing it at all, even though she was fired. In fact, she plans to use this newfound fame as kind of a springboard to work for an advocacy group for a cause that she believes in.
Okay.
But it's just a reminder, what you put on social media can have major consequences and can
kind of
blow out of control and blow out of proportion.
So basically, she gave the president the finger and got fired for it.
She did. And now she's trying to use that to leverage what she's doing in her life. So it's a story with twists and turns. But again, social media, what you put out there can always have consequences.
All right. Well, you got anything else?
Yes. So social media can get you fired, but it can also empower you in kind of an odd way. So Sia, the singer known for songs like Chandelier, Cheap Thrills, Titanium. She has that wig that she wears so you can never see her face.
Right.
Values her privacy, certainly. She was contacted by a paparazzi photographer who said that he had nude photos of her, and unless she paid up, he was going to release them. And he texted her one of the photos as proof and shows Sia with her back to the camera standing on a balcony in the distance, fully naked. Rather than paying up, though, Sia took things into her own hands. She took a screenshot of that text, including that nude photo, and she posted it to her Twitter account. And she wrote on the Twitter account with this photo, she says, "Someone is apparently trying to sell naked photos of me to my fans. Save your money. Here it is for free. Every day is Christmas." Not coincidence there. Every Day is Christmas is an upcoming Christmas album that she's releasing in the next couple months. But this is her early Christmas photo to everyone saying, "I'm releasing this photo for free. They can't blackmail me into paying." Fans loved this, not just because of the content of the photo. They said that it was her taking power over this photographer. We've talked a lot about sexual assault and sexual harassment, and this is one instance that a lot of celebrities face where photographers catch them off guard, maybe get photos of them in uncompromising situations, and try to blackmail them and say that they're going to ruin their careers unless they pay up. So fans say it's great that she used social media as a platform to try to take back that power.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week. Right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
I'm James Partey, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Countering Hezbollah is a top priority for the United States. That's why the U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism, Nathan Sales, announced rewards for two senior Hezbollah leaders under the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. The United States is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Talal Hamia. Hamia has been linked to several terrorist attacks, hijackings, and kidnappings targeting U.S. citizens. Hamia leads Hezbollah's International Terrorist Unit, the so-called External Security Organization, which is responsible for planning and conducting terrorist attacks outside of Lebanon. These attacks have targeted primarily Americans and Israelis. The U.S. is also offering a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Fuad Shukr. Shukr is a senior military commander of Hezbollah's forces in Lebanon. He's also a member of the Jihad Council, Hezbollah's highest military body. Shukr plays a key role in Hezbollah's military operations in Syria, and he helped plan and launch the 1983 attack on the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Beirut that killed 241 Marines. These are the first Hezbollah-related rewards under the Rewards for Justice program in a decade. This announcement is just one part of the effort to counter Hezbollah's terrorist activities, said Ambassador Sales. Until Hezbollah stops using terrorism and violence to achieve its goals, the United States and our allies will aggressively target its terrorism infrastructure and financial support networks. If you have any information about Talal Hamia or Fuad Shukr, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. You can also call 1-800-877-3927 or send mail to Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Absolute confidentiality is assured, and relocation may be available.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.